having grown up in a Navy household, and not only the son of a naval officer, actually two, my mom got out when my folks got married, but also in the person of my father, something of an amateur military historian, I was a weird kid. I don't think this is going to surprise anybody. I picked up all kinds of very adult sort of reading habits from various of my relatives, parents and grandparents and uncles, and among them, from a fairly early age, I was reading, full-out military history, eventually settling more on the Civil War, but really the first stuff I got into was World War II. There might actually be some folks here to whom the name of Samuel Eliot Morrison means something, probably most of you not, but the dean of American historians of that conflict, and particularly naval historians. Obviously, there's a bit of a bias in my household. I'm sure you can understand that. But if I were to ask you to name some of the principal leaders on the American side of World War II, let me just throw it out. Anybody want to come up with any? World War II. Eisenhower, of course, yes. Churchill. Well, yeah, Churchill, but he's Brit. With the British medal, we'll count that good enough for them. Gary. Nimitz. I figured somebody would come up with that. Halsey, very good. I wondered if anybody would mention Bull Halsey, fleet commander under Nimitz in the Pacific. Patton, of course. Probably more for the movie, really. It's just kind of overblown, but as far as his accomplishments, but that's a whole other argument. We don't need to get into that now. Ah, yes, I wonder if anybody mentioned Marshall, Army Chief of Staff during the war. Stilwell. Now we're really getting into it. This is not a name I would have ever imagined somebody would come up with. Nobody's going to mention FDR? You know, I didn't say military, I said leaders, interesting. Anybody, any others anybody wants to mention? Truman at the very end, this is true, only fair. Did somebody say MacArthur back there? Okay, I guess if nobody had, I would have been floored. Not only did he really accomplish a lot, but he's probably the most self-promoting and self-aggrandizing military man in the entire history of this country. The only other one that I thought y'all might come up with would have been, along with Halsey, Raymond Spruance. Thought there may be a possibility that somebody mentioned Frank Jack Fletcher, who was actually in command over Spruance at Midway, though Spruance really did more in that combat. But there was one name that I was quite sure I would not hear that is really a shame, really and truly a shame. No surprise on my part, no one mentioned Fleet Admiral Ernest J. King. And that omission is undeserved. King was, he'd kind of been more or less beached as things were ramping up. He was stuck on the general board, which is where they put senior officers that weren't going to retire, that they didn't really want to use. The CNO at the time, Harold Stark, went by Betty Stark, moved him in 1940 to the position of Commander-in-Chief Atlantic Fleet, Sinkland. And then after Pearl Harbor, at the end of December 1941, he was promoted to Commander-in-Chief U.S. Fleet. Then, a few months later, March 1942, they actually pushed Stark out the door, and he was put in the position of Chief of Naval Operations as well, making him actually the only person in United States history to be both Cominch, the senior operational commander of the entire fleet, and CNO, the senior administrative official for the entire Navy. No one's done it before, no one's done it since, and part of that is that, quite frankly, they don't make many men like Ernie King who could actually handle it. So he may have had more to do with it than anybody with how the war was won, given that, one, obviously, I mentioned FDR, and he didn't live through the entire thing, and that, two, fortunately for our nation, King was instrumental in the fact that we didn't end up invading Japan. But it's the thing, we all know that if you want to be famous, which he didn't, but if you want to be famous, you have to play along with the press. And King's idea of dealing with the press was to not deal with them. One reporter grumbled, echoing King's own words, actually, that if Admiral King had his way, the U.S. would issue one press release for the entire war, it would come when it was over, and it would read, quote, "We won," unquote. Yeah, not an easy man to deal with, not somebody who is really interested in cooperating very much, which is why really he did a lot better at the top of the food chain. Although, you know, he very nearly came to blows with some of his opposite numbers during, you know, Allied military conferences. Stilwell actually wished that he'd punched out, I think it was Montgomery at one point. Stilwell not being the gentlest individual himself. He was tough, he was demanding, he was abrasive, he was authoritarian, he was irascible, and he had a really bad short temper. FDR famously said of him at one point that he shaves each morning with a blowtorch. And when I say he was demanding, this really manifested particularly in the Atlantic Fleet, which of course he was commanding at the time that hostilities broke out. And his philosophy on things seems to have carried through in his successor there, Admiral Royal Ingersoll. There was a certain amount of resentment that built up over the course of the war between, you know, Atlantic Fleet veterans, officers and sailors, and those in the Pacific Fleet. Because, you know, in the Pacific Fleet, Nimitz running the show, and he was apparently, I mean, fairly reasonable guy as far as, you know, giving out military honors. Whereas the Atlantic Fleet operated on the principle once stated, actually more than once stated, by King, don't expect a medal for doing your job. Now, you may very well be thinking that this is a very odd introduction to a parable of Jesus, but in fact it has everything to do with this one. Because King's dictum is the lesson of this parable in a nutshell. And that might seem a strange thing to say, because we don't think of God as being like Ernie King. And indeed we shouldn't. This is a man of whom one of his daughters said, he is the most even-tempered person in the entire Navy. He is always in a rage. You know, if this is our conception of God, we have problems. But the problem that we also have, you know, in our, you know, increasingly, you know, casual and individualistic and at least what is outwardly authority-destroying society, is that we have a real tendency to go the other way. And certainly, you know, Jesus gives us, you know, a lot of material in that respect. We have another parable in Luke 12, you know, where he, you know, the master who serves his servants, you know, he says in John 15, you know, no longer do I call you servants, for the servant does not know what his master is doing, but I have called you friends. But the problem is that we go from there, and we sort of apply to that our very casual and our very loose model of friendship. And we start to think of him as being on our level. You know, buddy Jesus. And that is not what he's on about. Yes, he calls us friends. He invites us into his counsels to a considerable degree, to the extent that we can understand them, and indeed even beyond that. You know, but at the same time, we are still his servants. We're still just human, even with his spirit in our hearts. And he's still God, vastly greater and more powerful, more glorious and more good than we are. Yes, he loves us. Yes, he serves us, but that doesn't make us masters, and it doesn't make us equals. It's not because he owes us anything. It is simply by his grace. And to see that clearly, to really get that in this parable, we need to understand the context. And actually, we need to begin with the whole idea of what it means to be a servant. You know, we tend to think of that as, you know, rich people have servants and ordinary people don't. And very often, the idea that the work of the servant is kind of demeaning and you know, unfulfilling. Very different situation, that culture. Actually, most people in those days would have at least one servant. You know, the Talmud, the collection of Jewish, sort of the written collection of the Jewish oral law and regulations that began to be collected within a couple centuries of this time, assumes that everybody has at least one servant, because it was only the poorest of the poor who didn't. This, actually, master in this parable is probably fairly poor himself because he only has one. Same person who's out in the fields is also the one who is cooking dinner. So, you know, you're talking somebody who is, in our terms, on the lower end of the working class. It was only the poorest who didn't have servants, and they actually would very often hire their children out as household servants because it was at least a way of making sure they got fed. And that's a lot of the place that the work and the position, rather, of the servant had in that society, because it was, you know, time obviously didn't have, you know, our modern technology, they didn't have really kind of our modern economy and safety net and all that sort of thing. Security was very tenuous. You know, you were always really very close, except for the very richest, you know, very close to a point of complete catastrophe, materially speaking. Yeah, I noted earlier in this year that it was a world in which people dying of hunger and dying of thirst was not unfamiliar. You know, survival was a lot harder. And, you know, this is another place where American society in particular really doesn't help us. The Brits would get it more. But class and social status were extremely important, you know, in that situation, in that time and in that place. And so, you know, if you were poor, you know, if you really didn't have anything, you didn't have much of an opportunity to better yourself, but you could advance somewhat. You could move yourself up in your standing in the community if you were a servant to someone who was of some importance. And so to be a servant to a good master, at least, was, yes, it meant, you know, absolute obedience. It meant accepting, you know, the authority of another. But it also meant security. It meant having a place to live, a roof over your head, a bed to sleep in, having food to eat and food enough. Because obviously, if you want a servant to give you good work, you've got to make sure they have enough food. You've got to feed them well. And it meant, for those that had good masters at least, you know, it meant having a position that was of significance. It gave worth and gave meaning to life. So this was not a bad thing, it's, at least if you had a good master. And the master in this parable is. He's a very reasonable man. You know, the meal here is not dinner, it's supper, which was eaten about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So the servant has done a normal day's work outside. This is not anything, you know, terribly hard. And once he makes supper, then he'll have some time for himself. There would be, you know, the evening meal at around 8, but obviously, you know, a lighter sort of thing. This was the main meal of the day. So, you know, he's had a relatively short day's work outside. You know, he's got one main meal to prepare and, you know, probably some other chores, and then, you know, he has a block of time, you know, in the afternoon and into the evening, you know, where he can feed himself, where he can rest before it comes time to conclude the work of the day. So, you know, he's not being abused. He's not being treated with disrespect. He's under fair expectations, and all of his own needs are being met. This is not anyone who has any reason for discontent. He has no cause for complaint. Unfortunately, and some of you might be thinking about this from verse 9, our English translations obscure that. You know, the NIV typical, you know, will he thank him for what he's done? Which sounds like, okay, the guy's ungrateful, right? Well, no. Literally, what this says is he does not have grace for him because he's done what he's told, does he? And, you know, with some of the biblical writers, that can mean, you know, offering thanks. With Luke, you know, Luke's vocabulary, everybody uses words a little bit differently. You know, in Luke, this more, it has to do with an idea of special favor, special credit. The idea here really is he doesn't get a bonus for doing his ordinary work. You know, he doesn't get any special benefit just because he does what's expected of him. You know, Jesus poses that as a question, but of course everybody's going to say, no. I mean, you do a day's work, you get a day's pay. That's just the normal run of things. You know, you're not going to get anything extravagant just because you've done what you're supposed to do. But then, of course, there's verse 10, and this is one which has been a problem, you know, for a long time. And you might have snagged on that. You know, Jesus says we should say we're unworthy servants, which doesn't really fit with the rest of the parable. This is a guy who's clearly a worthy servant. I mean, he's done the plowing or the herding, and he's going to prepare dinner. I mean, he's doing what he's supposed to do. He's being useful. So what's this unworthy bit? And actually, the NIV is gentler there than a lot of them. You'll also see this translated useless, miserable. You get kind of the idea of miserable, good for nothing sort of thing, because that's how the word was usually used in the Greek. But the root of it just means without need. Yeah, it's a word that started off meaning just unneeded, unnecessary. And of course, because anything that can be negative will get more negative over time. You know, it's one of those standing rules of language, you know, anywhere. You know, it came to mean, well, you're not just unneeded because you're superfluous, you're unneeded because you're worthless, because you're miserable, you're good for nothing, you might as well just, you know, go off and jump in a creek or something. But the literal meaning of the word is still the same. Literally without need. You know, if you take away all the sort of connotations, all the assumptions about why somebody would be, you know, unneeded. And as Kenneth Bailey tells us, the literal translation of that word means something different in the Aramaic that Jesus spoke, you know, in the other Semitic languages of that region, than it does in the Greek. And so, you know, if you go to, you know, some of the translations from that part of the world, you know, into the Syriac, later translations into the Arabic, when the Arabs overran, you know, the, you know, Israel and the area around Jerusalem, you'll see that it's translated absolutely that way. We are servants without need. So, okay, what does that mean? Well, to give you an example, you know, let's say, you know, you're working on your house, and there's something that's, you know, you're trying, maybe trying to fix the door or whatever, and it just, you can't quite get it done. And somebody comes along and says, well, you know, I see what you're doing here. I see what's wrong. Let me just help you out. And maybe they have the tool that you don't have or whatever it might be. Yeah, you know, help you get the thing back on and it's, you know, operating properly. If you wanted to ask them, do I owe you anything? What you would say literally is there any need? And if this is somebody just coming along trying to be helpful, the response would be, there is no need. In other words, you don't owe me anything. It's all good. And that, you know, Dr. Bailey suggests, and I think he's right, that's the idea that's in view in verse 10. You know, it's not that we are unworthy servants, that what we do has no value, but that we are, in that sense, servants without need. God doesn't owe us anything for what we do. What he's telling his disciples to say, you know, is when you've done all that you were told to do, don't expect a medal for doing your job. Instead, say, we're your servants. This is our job. This is what we're supposed to do. You don't need to pay us extra for just taking care of business. And who is their master? Who is it who commands? It's God in the person of Jesus Christ, the Son. He calls us his friends because he involves us in what he's doing. But it's still about what he's doing. You know, we are not talking the model of obedience of the Light Brigade. Yeah, ours not to reason why, ours but to do or die, as Tennyson said. Into the valley of death rode the 500. You know, we are free to ask questions. God sometimes shows us amazing patience as we argue with him. You know, he certainly has me. I mean, there have been times that I was arguing with him, and quite frankly, if I was God, I would have blasted me. But, you know, God is very good and very gracious. But the fact is, there comes a time when we just have to shut up and soldier. When if we don't fully understand, because often we won't, because God is that much bigger than us, we have to obey anyway, as we've been commanded. You know, in the last analysis, God says and we do. Because he's God and we're not. This is simply what he deserves for his power and for his wisdom and for his greatness. Yeah, and any faith that doesn't get that, you know, any faith that doesn't regard Christ with the awe and submission that he deserves as king of creation is false at the core. At its heart is not love for God, but spiritual pride. And unfortunately, that is the religion of much of contemporary America, including an awful lot that calls itself evangelical. It's a too small faith in a too small God. Which, I mean, it really comes out of the desire to believe that we're not that bad. That really, yeah, you know, we've got issues, but they're not that big a deal. It doesn't matter that much. You know, and yes, we know we need God's help to deal with them. Yes, we know we need to grow, but it's not the end of the world. And so we move towards taking our own sin less and less seriously. Very natural thing to do. But as our view of our own sin shrinks, so does our view of grace. So does our gospel. Because little sins don't need anything more than a little gospel. And along with that, then, goes our understanding of God. God shrinks to meet our shrunken sense of what it is that we need from God. And so we lose the sense of his holiness and his glory and his power. We lose our sense of the distance between us and God and how great was the sacrifice necessary to bridge that distance. And you know, most of the time, through most of life, that'll get you by. That'll get you by. It's big enough to manage the everyday, if that's what you're looking for. But sooner or later, we hit something that we know is a big deal. We hit an injustice that we just cannot comprehend how that can be. We do something that we cannot rationalize and we cannot defend even to ourselves. We fall headfirst into a guilt that's deep enough to drown us. And if all the faith that we have, if all the belief in the grace of God that we have is just enough to cover what we think really isn't that bad, really isn't that big a deal, then we're in trouble. Because we've lost the belief that God can forgive what we can't, and that God can heal what we can't imagine being healed, and that God can carry what is too heavy for us to bear. Sooner or later, one way or another, we will hit a spiritual cataclysm. And we need to understand that we have a God big enough to calm that storm. But in order to see that, we need really to understand that, in fact, we're always carrying around a spiritual cataclysm. Our sin is always that serious. And the grace of God is always that big. Because God is that big. Because he is that much greater than we are. Because he isn't just on our level. Because we are his servants. And yes, that means obedience to authority. But it also means we are cared for. We are provided for. We have a home that we cannot lose. And we have one who will not abandon us. If we see this, if we really nurture in our hearts the awareness of the greatness and the goodness and the holiness of Christ, if we truly acknowledge him as Lord, not merely as friend, and we accept that our salvation is not a reward for services rendered, it's not a debt God owes us, it's a gift, then we have the assurance of knowing, of understanding, that our salvation is not dependent on us continuing to earn it. It's not dependent on us continuing to be good enough and not falling short. But rather, we simply say, we fall short. And God loves us anyway. And God has saved us anyway. And he takes care of us anyway. And he holds us together anyway. He provides for us anyway. And he hangs on to us regardless. Regardless of all of it. We understand that it's all by grace because he loves us. It's just a gift. No strings attached. And what service we give him isn't to earn it, doesn't earn it, can't earn it, simply because that's what he deserves. Simply because that's what we have to give back in gratitude for what he's done for us. Because he doesn't give us what we deserve. He gives us far, far more. And far, far better than we could ever ask or think or imagine. Let's pray.